Chapter 2. The public, that only a chosen few can relish it. The best humor that we know of has been as eagerly received by the public as by the most delicate connoisseur. There is hardly a man in England who can read, but will laugh at Falstaff and the humor of Joseph Andrews, and honest Mr. Pickwick's story can be felt and loved by any person above the age of 6. Some may have a keener enjoyment of it than others, but all the world can be merry over it, and is always ready to welcome it. The best criterion of good humor is success, and what a share of this has Mr. Cruikshank had, how many millions of mortals has he made happy! We have heard very profound persons talk philosophically of the marvelous and mysterious manner in which he has suited himself to the time fate viber la fiber popular as Napoleon boasted of himself, supplied a peculiar want felt at a peculiar period, the simple secret of which is, as we take it, that he, living amongst the public, has with them a general wide-hearted sympathy, that he laughs at what they laugh at, that he has a kindly spirit of enjoyment, with not a morsel of mysticism in his composition, that he pities and loves the poor, and jokes at the follies of the great, and that he addresses all in a perfectly sincere and manly way. To be greatly successful as a professional humorist, as in any other calling, a man must be quite honest, and show that his heart is in his work. A bad preacher will get admiration, and a hearing with this point in his favor, where a man of 3 times his acquirements will only find indifference and coldness. Is any man more remarkable than our artist for telling the truth after his own manner? Hogarth's honesty of purpose was as conspicuous in an earlier time, and we fancy that Gilray would have been far more successful and more powerful but for that unhappy bribe, which turned the whole course of his humor into an unnatural channel. Cruikshank would not for any bribe say what he did not think, or lend his aid to sneer down anything meritorious, or to praise anything or person that deserved censure. When he leveled his wit against the regent, and did his very prettiest for the princess, he most certainly believed, along with the great body of the people whom he represents, that the princess was the most spotless, pure-mannered darling of a princess, that ever married a heartless debauchee of a prince royal. Did not millions believe with him, and noble and learned lords take their oaths to her royal highness's innocence? Cruikshank would not stand by, and see a woman ill-used, and so struck in for her rescue, he and the people belaboring with all their might the party who were making the attack, and determining, from pure sympathy and indignation, that the woman must be innocent, because her husband treated her so foully. To be sure we have never heard so much from Mr. Cruikshank's own lips, but any man who will examine these odd drawings, which first made him famous, will see what an honest hearty hatred the champion of woman has for all who abuse her, and will admire the energy with which he flings his woodblocks at all who side against her. Canning, Castlereagh, Bexley, Sidmouth, he is at them, one and all. And as for the prince, up to what a whipping post of ridicule did he tie that unfortunate old man! And do not let squeamish Tories cry out about disloyalty. If the crown does wrong, the crown must be corrected by the nation, out of respect, of course, for the crown. In those days, and by those people who so bitterly attacked the son, no word was ever breathed against the father, simply because he was a good husband, and a sober, thrifty, pious, orderly man. This attack upon the Prince Regent we believe to have been Mr. Cruikshank's only effort as a party politician. Some early manifestos against Napoleon we find, it is true, done in the regular John Bull style, with the Gilray model for the little upstart Corsican. But as soon as the Emperor had yielded to stern fortune our artist's heart relented, as Barringer's did on the other side of the water, and many of our readers will doubtless recollect a fine drawing of Louis XVIII. Trying on Napoleon's boots, which did not certainly fit the gouty son of St. Louis. Such satirical hits as these, however, must not be considered as political, or as anything more than the expression of the artist's national British idea of Frenchman. It must be confessed that for that great nation Mr. Cruikshank entertains a considerable contempt. Let the reader examine the life in Paris, or the 500 designs in which Frenchmen are introduced, and he will find them almost invariably thin, with ludicrous spindle shanks, pigtails, outstretched hands, shrugging shoulders, and queer hair and mustachios. He has the British idea of a Frenchman, and if he does not believe that the inhabitants of France are for the most part dancing masters and barbers, yet takes care to depict such in preference, and would not speak too well of them. It is curious how these traditions endure. In France, at the present moment, the Englishman on the stage is the caricatured Englishman at the time of the war, with a shock red head, a long white coat, and invariable gaiters. Those who wish to study this subject should peruse Monsieur Paul de Kock's histories of Ord Belingrog and Addie Krokmilov. On the other hand, the old émigré has taken his station amongst us, and we doubt if a good British gallery would understand that such and such a character was a Frenchman, unless he appeared in the ancient traditional costume. A curious book, called Life in Paris, published in 1822, contains a number of the artist's plates in the Aquitaine style, and though we believe he had never been in that capital, the designs have a great deal of life in them, and pass muster very well. A villainous race of shoulder-shrugging mortals are his Frenchmen indeed. And the heroes of the tale, a certain Mr. Dick Wildfire, Squire Jenkins, and Captain O'Shuffleton, are made to show the true British superiority on every occasion when Britons and French are brought together. This book was one among the many that the designer's genius has caused to be popular. The plates are not carefully executed, but, being colored, have a pleasant, lively look. The same style was adopted in the once famous book called Tom and Jerry, or Life in London, which must have a word of notice here, for, although by no means Mr. Cruikshank's best work, his reputation was extraordinarily raised by it. Tom and Jerry were as popular 20 years since as Mr. Pickwick and Sam Weller now are, and often have we wished, while reading the biographies of the latter celebrated personages, that they had been described as well by Mr. Cruikshank's pencil as by Mr. Dickens' pen. As for Tom and Jerry, to show the mutability of human affairs and the evanescent nature of reputation, we have been to the British Museum and no less than 5 circulating libraries in quest of the book, and Life in London, alas, is not to be found at any one of them. We can only, therefore, speak of the work from recollection, but have still a very clear remembrance of the leather gaiters of Jerry Hawthorne, the green spectacles of Logic, and the hooked nose of Corinthian Tom. They were the schoolboy's delight, and in the days when the work appeared we firmly believed the 3 heroes above named to be types of the most elegant, fashionable young fellows the town afforded, and thought their occupations and amusements were those of all high-bred English gentlemen. Tom knocking down the watchman at Temple Bar, Tom and Jerry dancing at Almack's, or flirting in the saloon at the theater, at the night houses, after the play, at Tom Cribb's, examining the silver cup then in the possession of that champion, at the chambers of Bob Logic, who, seated at a cabinet piano, plays a waltz to which Corinthian Tom and Kate are dancing, ambling gallantly in Rotten Row, or examining the poor fellow at Newgate who was having his chains knocked off before hanging. All these scenes remain indelibly engraved upon the mind, and so far we are independent of all the circulating libraries in London. As to the literary contents of the book, they have passed sheer away. It was, most likely, not particularly refined. Nay, the chances are that it was absolutely vulgar. But it must have had some merit of its own, that is clear. It must have given striking descriptions of life in some part or other of London, for all London read it, and went to see it in its dramatic shape. The artist, it is said, wished to close the career of the 3 heroes by bringing them all to ruin, But the writer, or publishers, would not allow any such melancholy subjects to dash the merriment of the public, and we believe Tom, Jerry, and Logic were married off at the end of the tale, as if they had been the most moral personages in the world. There is some goodness in this pity, which authors and the public are disposed to show towards certain agreeable disreputable characters of romance, who would mar the prospects of honest Roderick Random, or Charles Surface, or Tom Jones. Only a very stern moralist indeed. And in regard of Jerry Hawthorne, and that hero without a surname, Corinthian Tom, Mr. Cruikshank, we make little doubt, was glad in his heart that he was not allowed to have his own way. Soon after the Amman Jerry and the If in Paris, Mr. Cruikshank produced a much more elaborate set of prints, in a work which was called Oints of Humor. These points were selected from various comic works, and did not, we believe, extend beyond a couple of numbers, containing about a score of copper plates. The collector of humorous designs cannot fail to have them in his portfolio, for they contain some of the very best efforts of Mr. Cruikshank's genius, and though not quite so highly labored as some of his later productions, are none the worse, in our opinion, for their comparative want of finish. All the effects are perfectly given, and the expression is as good as it could be in the most delicate engraving upon steel. The artist's style, too, was then completely formed, and, for our parts, we should say that we preferred his manner of 1825 to any other which he has adopted since. The first picture, which is called The Point of Honor, illustrates the old story of the officer who, on being accused of cowardice for refusing to fight a duel, came among his brother officers, and flung a lighted grenade down upon the floor, before which his comrades fled ignominiously. This design is capital, and the outward rush of heroes, walking, trampling, twisting, scuffling at the door, is in the best style of the grotesque. You see but the back of most of these gentlemen, into which, nevertheless, the artist has managed to throw an expression of ludicrous agony that one could scarcely have expected to find in such a part of the human figure. The next plate is not less good. It represents a couple who, having been found one night tipsy, and lying in the same gutter, were, by a charitable though misguided gentleman, supposed to be man and wife, and put comfortably to bed together. The morning came. Fancy the surprise of this interesting pair when they awoke and discovered their situation. Fancy the manner, too, in which Cruikshank has depicted them, to which words cannot do justice. It is needless to state that this fortuitous and temporary union was followed by one more lasting and sentimental, and that these two worthy persons were married and lived happily ever after. We should like to go through every one of these prints. There is the jolly miller, who, returning home at night, calls upon his wife to get him a supper, and falls to upon rashers of bacon and ale. How he gormandizes, that jolly miller! Rasher after rasher, how they pass away frizzling, and, smoking from the gridiron down that immense grinning gulf of a mouth. Poor wife! How she pines and frets, at that untimely hour of midnight, to be obliged to fry perpetually, and minister to the monster's appetite. And yonder in the clock, what agonized faces that we see! By heavens, it is the squire of the parish! What business has he there? Let us not ask. Suffice it to say that he has, in the hurry of the moment, left upstairs his BR, his saw, a part of his dress, in short, with a number of banknotes in the pockets. Look in the next page, and you will see the ferocious, bacon-devouring ruffian of a miller is actually causing this garment to be carried through the village and cried by the town crier. And we blush to be obliged to say that the demoralized miller never offered to return the banknotes, although he was so mighty scrupulous in endeavoring to find an owner for the corduroy portfolio in which he had found them. Passing from this painful subject, we come, we regret to state, to a series of prints representing personages not a whit more moral. Burns' famous Ali beggars of all at their portraits drawn by Cruikshank. There is the lovely Empan widow, quite as interesting and romantic as the famous Mrs. Shepherd, who has at the lamented demise of her husband, adopted the very same consolation. Why curse upon them everyone, they've hanged my braw John Highlandman. ... And now a widow I must mourn departed joys that never return. No comfort but a hearty can, when I think on John Highlandman. Sweet Uncle Carlin, as he has none of the sentimentality of the English highwayman's lady, but being wooed by a tinker, and pygmy scraper why his fiddle wasset to trysts and fairs to driddle, prefers the practical to the merely musical man. The tinker sings with a noble candor, worthy of a fellow of his strength of body and station in life. Why, bonny lass, I work in brass, a tinker is my station. I've traveled round all Christian ground and is my occupation. I've tanned the gold, I've been enrolled in many a noble squadron. But vain they searched, when off I marched to go, and clout the cauldron. It was his ruling passion. What was military glory to him, forsooth? He had the greatest contempt for it, and loved freedom and his copper kettle a thousand times better a kind of hardware Diogenes. Of fiddling he has no better opinion. The picture represents the turdy care-taking Urgut scraper by the beard, drawing his usty rapier, and swearing to peat him like a pliver, unless he would relinquish the bonny lassie forever, I ghastly e. Poor Tweedledee upon his hunkers bended, and prayed for grace why Ruifu face, and so the quarrel ended. Hark how the tinker apostrophizes the violinist, stating to the widow at the same time the advantages which he might expect from an alliance with himself. Espies that shrimp, that withered imp, why a his noise and caperin, and take a share with those that bear the budget and the apron. And ye by that stope, my faith and hoop, and by that dear cold baby. If e'er ye want, or meet why scant, may I never weep my craggy. Cruikshank's cared is a noble creature. His face and figure show him to be fully capable of doing, and saying all that is above written of him. In the second part, the old tale of the three hunchbacked fiddlers is illustrated with equal felicity. The famous classical dinners and duel in Aragorn Pickle are also excellent in their way, and the connoisseur of prints and etchings may see in the latter plate, and in another in this volume, how great the artist's mechanical skill is as an etcher. The distant view of the city in the duel, and of a marketplace in the Quack Doctor, are delightful specimens of the artist's skill in depicting buildings and backgrounds. They are touched with a grace, truth, and dexterity of workmanship, that leave nothing to desire. We have before mentioned the man with the mouth, which appears in this number emblematical of gout and indigestion, in which the artist has shown all the fancy of Callot. Little demons, with long saws for noses, are making dreadful incisions into the toes of the unhappy sufferer. Some are bringing pans of hot coals, to keep the wounded member warm. A huge solemn nightmare sits on the invalid's chest, staring solemnly into Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.